Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Always wanted to do that. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club, by and for people in their 20s and 30s and beyond, with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I'm Carla Marinucci, the political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. And tonight for President Obama, let's break it down. We're going to hear from a panel of experts discussing the November election. It's been a couple of weeks. We're all junkies. We're all going through withdrawal. It's really time to talk about issues, trends, things that affected the election. Was YouTube really the thing that make or broke Obama? Will the election of our first African-American president change politics? How did the issues affect the upcoming election? Tonight, let me introduce you to our panel. Frank Russo created and publishes the California Progress Report. He's been active in California politics for 40 years. He's published many pieces focusing on workers' compensation issues. Mark DiCamillo next, the director of the Field Poll. That is the poll used by political reporters and the Chronicle. It's an independent, nonpartisan, media-sponsored public opinion news service which has issued over 2,300 different reports since 1947. Next is Josh Richmond, my political reporting colleague, covers state and federal politics for the Bay Area news group East Bay. He's a frequent guest on KQED's This Week in Northern California, and he's well known for his well-read and very wonderful political blotter blog. And finally, Tom Del Beccaro, the vice chair of the California Republican Party. 5 years ago, he launched politicalvanguard.com, also very well-known conservative a blog and must reading for those of us in politics. We're going to start by just talking about the election, and we're going to be taking your questions a little bit later on. So let's just get right to it. The election, gentlemen, and we're going to have a sort of freewheeling discussion up here. Then I want you all to come up, line up, and ask whatever you want. But let's talk about the Barack Obama win. Was it just brilliant strategy politically? Was it luck, or was it the sheer incompetence of his opponents? What is the single biggest factor, in your view, when it came to this election, and what gave Obama that win? Let's just throw it out there. Richmond, why don't you start?
Yes.
It was all of those things. I mean, I think it's clear that you know, it was a very well-run campaign. It had... All of the good things about Howard Dean's 2004 internet savvy sort of campaign, but this had a ground game to go with it, and an unprecedented ground game at that. It had boots on the ground everywhere. And it had the appearance of being a very organic, grassroots, wiki sort of campaign, but in reality it was really a very disciplined sort of message that they managed to stick to, both through the primary season and the general season. So it was a great campaign, but I mean, you know, an historically abysmally unpopular incumbent Republican president and an economic downturn of immense proportions. And I know I'm going to take some heat from this, but a questionable vice presidential pick. Sorry, Tom. We'll argue about that in a minute. And I think just, you know, the comparative tones of the campaigns, you know, I think it's a lot easier to find the moments where the McCain campaign went wrong than the moments when the Obama campaign went wrong.
You know, if I could, there's really a lot of predictable elements to this race. You know, historically, all the way throughout history, people turn more towards government in bad economic times, and they turn away from government in high tax times. And this was a bad economic time that the Republicans flat out failed to tie to the fact that we have the second highest tax burden in American history. I mean, if you're in the audience, raise your hand if you knew it's the second highest tax burden in American history. One or two people raising your hands. So this was just it's not surprising that we find people looking for a government solution in a bad economic times, unless, of course, the other party does a brilliant job of defining why that's not a good alternative. And so if you look at this, it's not surprising in a bad economic times that someone advocating government won. There's other factors, too, that make this predictable. We live in such a high definition, 24/7. It's going to be very hard for any party to survive 8 straight years of scrutiny every single day and not get and for people not to get tired of that party. 8 years from now, if the Democrats don't succeed, you might look at it that there's too much coverage. You know, certainly FDR wouldn't look the same in today's coverage as he did then, and maybe Lincoln never wins re-election. I guarantee he wouldn't win re-election.
It was a little more than just not getting tired of this incumbent party. I mean, if you looked at the polling data, there was this really pent-up demand for change among the electorate even before the economic downturn of the last few months. There was record low job performance ratings of the president, the direction of the country, 5-1 negative. I mean, if you gave these data over to a political scientist at the beginning of the year and said who is going to win in this election year, they would almost unanimously say the out-party nominee, whoever that would be. And I think that's really one of the reasons why Hillary Clinton fought tooth and nail to the very end, because I think she truly believed that whoever the nominee of the Democratic Party was going to likely become the president. And certainly I give a lot of credit to the Obama campaign for first outflanking Clinton and then, you know, running a very effective general election campaign. But I think he was, if you think of the whole year, he was the right candidate for this moment, it seems. It was a change election year. He appeared on the scene as someone out of the blue, totally different, totally new. He even, outflanked Clinton in that regard. So I think Obama was just the right person for the times, but I mean, certainly believe that the times were running strongly against the Republican Party.
And I want to quibble a little bit with Tom's description of 8 years of scrutiny. I think there'll be a lot more scrutiny coming up once Obama is in the White House to look at some of the things that the Bush administration tried to keep secret from us. But taking a look at the election and analyzing it, I think one of the things that really has not been talked about that much that's obvious from a strategy point of view is that this is the first campaign in many years where the Democratic nominee was able to tell one narrative and not have to switch to a number of different narratives. It was change from the beginning when he announced. It was change when he won the primaries. And it was change on Election Day. And there was tremendous discipline within the Obama campaign. It is correct to say that this was a grassroots campaign, that Barack Obama tapped into a number of average Americans, a number of people that had not been involved in politics before, people that had been dispirited, and was able to get this welling up that is unlike anything I've seen since the 1960s. He was able to get contributions from over 3 million Americans and to do that directly online. He didn't go to the fat cats, at least at the beginning. He had large numbers of volunteers. There was a tremendous enthusiasm gap in his favor with people going out of state to work for him, people coming in and working on the campaign. So with a campaign that was as top-down and direct as it was, because when the volunteers came in, they didn't get to do their thing. They had a program that they put them into. They made calls where they were needed to be made. This campaign was very focused on what it took to win, very strategic. But they did not have a lot of other messages going on, either by Obama or by surrogates. They used far less surrogates than they had used before. And I think that stable campaign that was run for a 2-year time period is really the perhaps undertold story of this election, and one where I think there was a tremendous campaign run by Barack Obama.
Well, Frank, let me ask, though, why is it, though, that so many of us in the media, because I covered this campaign on the ground, all the caucuses from the beginning, many of us thought Obama, well, gee, interesting candidate, but Hillary Clinton, there's no way he's going to get past her. A year ago, if you would have asked any of us, we were all wrong. What can I say? Why did that go past us so quickly? I mean, why did we not call this sooner?
The Hillary Clinton campaign had the support of a lot of party insiders and people that wanted to get on the train before it left the station. But it's kind of like a Maginot line. I think Obama was strategic. He saw where he could go into the caucus states in particular, where he racked up win after win. And, you know, once there was a glass jaw with the Clinton campaign, it was kind of over. But I saw this in March of 2007 when there were 500 people gathered in Oakland on a Sunday to prepare for Barack Obama's first big speech in Oakland that occurred a week later.
That's right. Josh, you were there.
Yes,
we were both there in Oakland when 15,000 people showed up. Was that to you the moment? What was the moment? I'd like to hear your thoughts too, Tom. The moment when you believed that Barack Obama, this was for real, this was really happening.
Yeah, I don't think you could have been at that rally and not realized that there was something significant going on. Whether or not that was going to amount to something that could best Hillary Clinton's machine, I'm not sure we saw all that clearly at that point. I think I was probably still where you are, you know, saying, wow, this is really something, but, you know, in the end it's going to be a footnote. But as time wore on, we saw that was translating into not only 15,000 people at a rally, but a captain for every voting precinct in California. You realize that this really had become something more than people coming out to Franco Gawa Plaza on a Sunday. This was actually some sort of a movement.
But the fact that you had 500 people on a Sunday, the week before he came out here, and you know, a year and a half or two years or however long it was before the election really said something to me.
Well, I mean, and, you know, the reality, when did it become real for Obama versus Hillary? I think in September of October before the primaries, because that's when the Hillary campaign was hit flat-footed. Because the reality is, if at that moment you didn't realize that he was translating this not only into volunteers but into money, I was stunned that he wins Iowa and basically the Clintons had no real response. They were completely clay-footed at that moment. But I want to put a little bit of perspective before we run away with a 52% victory and the whole world has changed. The reality is that his message was change, which doesn't actually tell you where they're going to go. It just says change. And sometimes that works. Ask Herbert Hoover. That works really well. You don't have to say very much. If things are bad enough, you can win on change alone. In close elections, often you have to say exactly where you want to go. Reagan pulled away from Carter in bad economic times, worse than today, I'll say, with 13% inflation, which is far harder to get rid of than unemployment on high inflation, double-digit inflation. The reality is that Reagan became very defined and said, this is where we're going to go, and made a difference. Obama, I agree, discipline. The campaign was good. The way they raised money, very good. But I wouldn't get so carried away. The underlying, as Mark demonstrated, the underlying currents were certainly running his direction. And let's face it, the way the media works, the media is a business, and they want something interesting. And Barack Obama in 2007 was far more interesting character than the Clintons again, and they followed the story. And look, to show how important this is, when John McCain beat George Bush in the primary in 2000 in New Hampshire, everybody heard about it. Nobody heard about how Bradley came from 34 points down and only lost by 4 or 5 to Al Gore. So that was a stunning closing of the gap. But nobody heard about it, and shortly thereafter, Bradley's campaign was done. So the media, and don't take my word for it, take the Clintons' word for it.
I want to talk about the role of the media. But Mark DiCamillo, talk about the polls, what you were seeing among Californians from more than a year ago, from before the primary, their concerns about this election. Was it the media? What was driving the election?
No. I think, you know, with Obama, the most striking thing was the composition of his support. Even in the primary, it was a youth-oriented vote, and I think that's what brought this tremendous amount of excitement and interest that separated this election from others of the recent past. I mean, you'd really have to go back to maybe the 1960 election with Kennedy to see that same kind of just enthusiasm among young, a new generation of voters just wanting somebody new and different. And, I mean, in polling, you know, one of the interesting phenomenons of the Reagan years was that Reagan actually did create a kind of bubble, a demographic bubble of people who, when they came of age, were Reagan supporters, and they remained Republican and kind of Reagan allegiant voters throughout their entire lives, and we can still see them in the data. I think in this election, I think we're seeing this, the creation of an Obama generation, an Obama bubble that will be with us for a long time. So I think this is a major shift in politics, and it's certainly benefiting.
Tom Del Picaro wants in on this.
If Reagan didn't do well, we wouldn't be hanging by him. Obama has the opportunity to solidify this. But if things go wrong, if his choice for attorney general turns out really bad, as I think it will, and it discourages people, or if he doesn't turn the economy around, he's got a great opportunity. But there's nothing for sure here. What is for sure is that voters are more demanding than ever, and I don't want to say fickle, but they're willing to go with who has the answer. So he's got a great opportunity. Does he convert it? Call us back in 4 years.
Okay, but on the youth vote, and I'm going to hear from Josh what you were seeing on the ground in terms of those young voters, those young people out there. Did they turn out, Mark, in bigger percentages than in the past? How much? You talked about the Obama generation, and we can't leave out the Latino vote as well.
I mean, if you talk about the general election, you really have to tie together the two here in California. Young voters, first-time voters, were 14% of the electorate. That's higher than the nation. It was 11%, I think, nationally. And the reason that it was higher here is because we had many more first-time minority ethnic voters. I mean, the combined proportions of ethnic voters were over a third, probably about 35% of all voters in this state were either Latino, African-American, Asian. And those voters voted over 3-1 for Obama. I mean, there was question in the early going, I think in the primaries, would the Latinos be able to easily transfer their allegiance from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama? There was no question at the end of the game that Obama had the strong support of Latinos. So, you know, the outreach of the Obama effort and just the message, I think, especially here in California, change and trying on, the new thing and accepting something new is, I think, more commonplace, and it is more Californian. And when Maria Shriver got up there at the in the primary and said this man embodies what California is, I think she was right on a number of points.
Frank, why was Obama able to get the Latino vote? And Tom, on the flip side, and then I want to hear from Josh from the media side, why was McCain unable to get the Latino vote, considering his action on immigration? It was said that he was going to be able to attract Latinos. Frank, what's your take on that?
First of all, I think you have to understand that the Latino vote, quote unquote, is not one monolith. There are many different parts to it. And if you have a message that Obama had about the economy, a message of hope, I think it resonated with them as it resonated with a lot of voters of in different groups. The scuttlebutt, the buzz of the media was, will Hispanics vote for a black? There's tension between the races and all that. Same thing was said of the women vote, and yet Hispanics came home. Obama won the women's vote 56-43 by a much larger margin than he did with men. So, and he got the Clinton Democrats voted for him 83%-16%. These were things that a number of folks on my website were predicting would happen eventually, that Democrats would come home, Republicans would come home to a slightly less degree. The swing voters, the independents voted overwhelmingly for Obama, and that's, I think, where a large part of it happened. I can just say in this state, with some of the ballot propositions we've had on immigration, that has not done the Republican Party a good service as far as the Hispanic vote here. And nationwide, there are many differences. I think Obama did not win the Hispanic vote in Florida, for instance, but came a lot closer than Kerry did. So I know this, having worked in Pennsylvania, that a lot of the Hispanic votes back east are Caribbean, from the Caribbean area, and they can be a bit different than the Spanish-speaking votes that we have here that are from Mexico and Latin America and the like.
One other thing about the demographics, the white vote. Obama nationwide lost the white vote by, I believe, 10 or 12 points. But the interesting thing that I saw in the national exit polls is if you pull out the South and you look at whites in all other parts of the country, it was evenly divided. And I think that's a tremendous accomplishment for an first African-American legitimate presidential
candidate. And he did better with the white vote, did he not, than Kerry had or Gore had?
Kerry, for certain.
So, Tom, what about it? What happened with McCain and the Latinos? Let's start there. Then we'll go to McCain in other areas.
You know, the reality is that the last eight presidential winners have been perceived as having the more dynamic personality than the last eight losers. And the reality is that Barack Obama was young and energetic, and that helped him with a new generation of voters, and that drew them out. As you head towards the Latinos in California, though, I think, Mark, you can correct me, they got a higher than normal turnout. And look, the Latinos know that the Democrats are easier on immigration than the Republicans may or may not be. So, you know, I think the reality is the Republicans need to do a better job, and that John McCain never really focused on that. And I think they got swept up in sort of the newness of this. I think, you know, there was a talk of whether race would be an issue in this election, and I wrote an article as to why the Democrats won this time, which is out on the table out there. I think just as many people voted for Obama as allegedly people who refused to vote for Obama. So the long-term current with regard to Latinos is something that needs to be addressed. I don't think this election changed it dramatically. It's still a problem from our point of view. Republicans need to do a much better job. But I think it was just symptomatic of some of the other problems, which is, frankly, the Republicans don't have a good theme right now. And if you're not telling people where you're going to take them, you can't expect them to follow you.
I want to ask about the role of the media in this whole campaign. I'll just give you my story because I reported from Grant Park on election night in Chicago. Those thousands of people there, I was in the media tent where there were hundreds of media from all over the world, more than I'd ever seen. And when that final word came over on the Jumbotron that it was President-elect Barack Obama, I had reporters coming to me from Poland, Japan, coming up, tears going down their face. This is a great news for your country, and they're hugging and kissing. Was the media in the tank for Barack Obama, Josh Richmond?
No. No, you know, I relatively categorically reject that idea. And I'll explain why.
Relatively categorically.
Right. Well, you know, I'm sitting next to politicians here, so...
You're in between two lawyers.
You're sounding like a lawyer yourself.
Walk carefully.
Watch it here.
And
I knew I should have gone to law school.
Work in your comments that 62% of the people in the Rasmussen poll said the media was trying to help Obama.
Okay. Well, I mean, what I'll say is this. You know, we covered the news that was on the scene. When you made reference before to ask the Clintons how the media helped Obama, the media reported on what was going on the streets, and what was going on the streets was this unprecedented outpouring of interest and emotion among this younger generation. You know, quite frankly, if I can pound the stake through the heart of my own industry, the younger generation doesn't read the newspapers. So blaming it on us really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. On election night, while you were in Grant Park, I had to stick around here in Oakland, and I was at an Obama phone bank in the final hours where they were still calling Iowa and Colorado, and there's this 14-year-old girl sitting there, phoning furiously as fast as she can, and I talked to her dad, and her dad says, well, she brought me here. I've never been involved in a campaign before, and I wouldn't have been involved in this, but she wanted to come. She's been here four times now. She brought three of her friends, and she got me to come, too. You didn't see that for John Kerry. You sure as heck didn't see it for John McCain. But I don't think it was the media that put that girl in the seat dialing for Obama. I think it was
Let me just read you from Mr. Del Beccaro's blog today, and I'd like to hear Frank and Mark your thoughts on this too. He says, while there are a number of factors that led to Obama's victory, including Republican deficiencies, the power of the media all but handed Obama a victory when it should have heralded his doom.
Well, let me
get on
that.
What do you mean by that, Tom DelBocaro?
Well, I mean, here's the reality. When John Edwards, when the Inquirer had that story, John Edwards and Hillary were teaming, or John Edwards and Obama were teaming up in an effort to beat Hillary. John Edwards should have been out at the race at that moment because the whole world should have known what he was doing to his cancer-stricken wife. And if he was gone and it became Obama versus Hillary, it would have been much harder for Obama to win. Gary Hart, he had an affair. He was immediately driven out. The reality is if the media spent a lot of time digging out where he was in Colombia and some of these other things, it could have made it a lot harder on Obama to get past a lot of these issues. Well, these are the arguments that the Clintons made, and they're not illogical to say that if the media would have dug into these past issues that didn't come up, why didn't Obama ever answer the question, where were you born, in a debate when that was actually the focus of some things?
Oh,
now look,
Tom, are you really saying that you—
I'm really saying that the media could have spent— they spent a lot— look,
I'm not alone in this.
Public record 60,
where he was born.
62% of Americans— that's a huge number in a poll, thought the media was trying to help Obama. That's a huge number for a poll like that, the largest ever. To think that the media was not— look, the negative stories on McCain were running double what they were on Obama. Double.
Well, I dare say that he provided a lot of material for the negative reporting in the erratic way that his campaign was run and in a whole lot of other ways. And there's one thing, you know, the media is a variety of things. It's not a monolith. It's not all print, Carla, I'm sorry to say, or Josh. It's not just television. It's not just radio. It's all the stuff going on the Internet. It's all the buzz. It's all the YouTubes that are there. People are communicating with one another through Facebook. They're Twittering. They're doing things that I don't even understand.
So the Hillary Hillary's all wrong.
Well, I think so. And there's an excitement about Obama that existed and that grew upon people, such that on election day, if you look at the exit polls, by a 2-to-1 number, people who voted said they were excited about the prospect of Obama winning versus McCain winning. And it's hard for me to fathom, and I'm a Democrat. My initials are FDR. It's hard for me to fathom how people could be excited if McCain won. I understand it about Obama.
Let me jump in here for just a second, because I had a feeling we were going to be talking about this tonight. So I went on your website, Tom, earlier today, and I found this article, I think from a couple of days back, when you had talked about why the media didn't investigate and highlight certain things about the Obama campaign. And in between writing today about Barbara Lee and gay marriage and medical marijuana, I took a look just at the first five. And within an hour, I had basically figured out that we did investigate and highlight these things to the point that they were essentially disproven. So the first one, Obama's overseas internet fundraising,
Who's we?
Well, you were talking about the mass media, weren't you?
But you separated, and rightly so, the print media, which is declining, and NBC, CBS, ABC, and CNN, which has a much different impact. And you can go on the Internet and find stories about his Internet fundraising from overseas. Correct. But whether that is actually communicated to people such that it is within their psyche on election day, that's a totally different story.
But Tom, I'm going to speak up on this one, too, because I'm following Josh on this. One of the areas that you cite that wasn't covered, why did the San Francisco Chronicle not trumpet Obama's coal remarks?
Those are staggering remarks for one of the most important industries in America. Forget whether you agree with him or not. It was not in your print story. Nobody listens to 43 minutes, Carla, of a recording on a website. Nobody listens to 43 minutes.
No.
That should have been right in your story. Obama thinks that the industry that supplies 45% of all of our electricity should go bankrupt.
Well, I'm going to challenge you on it. I'm going to challenge you on that one because, first of all, Obama did not say, as you've said and many conservatives have said, that he would bankrupt the coal industry. That is not what he said.
Did I say that?
That is what many conservatives have said. It's just not true.
Governor Palin
and John McCain suggested there was a hidden video, which we have never put out there. It was out there for more than 9 months, and no one made anything of it, including the McCain campaign. So I'm wondering, we can all talk about this.
And to follow up and to finish my point from earlier, it's not so much a matter of the fact that some outlet investigated and highlighted these things as the fact that when they did, many of these were debunked. And I can tell you that newspapers, TV, internet, what have you, are not in the habit, or at least the mainstream media outlets are not in the habit of publicizing things that have been found not to be true. We don't concentrate on the things that have come up from the ether and we've disproven. We actually try to sort of stick to what's actually happening. When it came to a question of who funded Obama's stay at Harvard, once the person who the 80 or 90 year old person who had made that accusation had retracted it, and his family had said that he really actually didn't recall what had happened, we didn't write about it anymore because there was nothing to write about.
Josh's point is well taken.
I'm sticking with the 62% in the Clintons.
I want to move on to the next topic, though, and that is the change in the way this media, the multimedia covered the election, YouTube, the bloggers, and what I call the designer media. If you were conservative, you probably listen to Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, you go to townhall.com. If you're on the progressive side, a lot of folks go to MSNBC, they listen to Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann, Huffington Post. This sort of division, Mark, I'm wondering if you think that this has sort of changed, and the issue of YouTube and its role in this election. Both Frank and Tom are bloggers. Josh and I are also on our news sites. But I'm wondering, did the blogosphere, did all that new media really add to the coverage or just add to the noise?
Well, Pew did a very interesting post-election survey, which just came out, I believe, last Friday. And they were just reporting on voters, where they got their information in this presidential election year. And, they show television is still a big player. There's no question. But the biggest change numbers that you saw in the survey had to do with just people going to the web. And then they went further and asked people, well, which websites did you go to? And you saw a lot of what you're describing. You saw these little niches based on ideology. But what really struck me about the web was there was kind of two elements to it. The first was just the mass element. Where did the masses of people go on the web? And basically, and this is somewhat surprising, they followed the television cable news networks to their websites. That was by far the number one segment where people went to get information about on the web, to get information about the presidential election. It dwarfed the New York Times, Drudge Report, Huffington, all the other things that are very well known and kind of expected to be the new wave of media. But I still find that one finding, that it's still CNN.com and MSNBC.com and Fox.com that really are attracting the eyeballs. But then on the other hand, I think the activists really went and used the web in ways, and to Obama's advantage, to organize, to get the message out, to raise money. That was an entirely different sphere. We're not talking about the masses there. We're talking about the smaller niches of activists. So I think there were really two strong elements, and they're here with us to stay. Those will continue to grow as we move to the next election cycle.
I agree, and it's a kind of a crazy mixed-up world that we live in here as far as the media is concerned. You have newspapers that have bloggers, and you have blog sites or websites that have people producing journalistic quality articles, and you have less and less space in the traditional media, certainly in the news hole of the newspapers. There's a lot of infotainment on television. And there's a cross-fertilization that goes on. We could have another panel on this where material that surfaces on websites ends up being picked up by the mass media and vice versa. And what you had in this election, I think, is the ability of people to actually see and hear the candidates. You could watch entire speeches over and over and over again, even if they're the same speech sometimes being delivered in different cities. So I think it's unprecedented the amount of information people had about this campaign if they wanted to partake of it.
There's so much to get to, and we're going to get to questions in just about 5 minutes, so start thinking of that. But I want to ask about on the Republican side. I've just got to get a question in on Sarah Palin. I covered her on the ground in numerous rallies. Tom Del Beccaro, what, you know, disaster or debutante? Which one was she? And we're going to see more of her.
Anybody who thinks she's a negative factor does not understand grassroots politics. The reality is John McCain was not going to drive out basic Republican votes to any dramatic degree. She came in there, and let me tell you, I traveled, sir, the entire state of California, visiting 58 counties in the last 3 years, and talked to county chairs. And the reason why there were so many Republican volunteers all over the country, many, many of them related to Sarah Palin. And so would the election be closer if she had not been in? I don't think so, and neither does Dick Morris, and he knows something about those kind of elections.
Dick Morris.
The reality is she drove a ton of volunteers out. In the offices I visited, she drove volunteers out. But look, she did not determine this election. The reality is we had a bad economic time. Obama was able to ride the change issue. The Republicans did not have a convincing counter message. Frankly, they haven't had a convincing counter message since 2004. And when you add up all those things together, the fact that he was able to outspend him 3-1, in part because their internet fundraising is dramatically better than the Republicans, when you add up those three things, you get a 52% victory. But this is not a watershed election. FDR's in 32 was watershed. Johnson was watershed with 68 senators and 290 House seats. Before we run off into oblivion, he got 52% of the vote, which is the same amount that Prop 8 passed for, and nobody is saying Prop 8 won with a landslide. It was a bare victory, 52%, and 52% remains a victory, but not a runaway election.
Well, let the record reflect that he got 52.7%. And that McCain got 45.9%, and that there were other votes there, so it's a much wider margin than Prop 8 or other propositions. It's a 6.8% margin. He got the highest share of the vote that any Democrat has gotten since I don't know when, perhaps Jimmy Carter, but for many, many, many years. And I think some of what Tom has said is true, and that is that I think John McCain realized that in order to have some excitement about his campaign, and in order to get out the Republican base and to motivate them to make phone calls and to turn out and everything, he needed to do something, and Sarah Palin did that for him. However, I think with a lot of independent voters, people that were looking at McCain, thinking about him, it turned them off. And it was a question mark about his judgment in putting her on the ticket. If you look at the exit polls, 66% of the voters said that Joe Biden was qualified if he had to become president, by a 66-32 margin, and by the almost the mirror opposite, by a 36-60% margin, they felt that Palin was not qualified to be president. And I think that probably helped net to Obama. And maybe Mr.
Mark,
D. Yeah,
absolutely.
I just want to get a word in edgewise among the lawyers. And I sort of building on what Frank said, you know, I hear exactly what Tom's saying, and I agree to some extent. But she would have been a great candidate to have on the ticket if you had vice presidential candidates on the ticket in the primary for mobilizing that primary base. When you're trying to get the middle-of-the-road voters, you know, the undecideds and independents, this wasn't the pick to make. It created a lot of heat and light for about 2 weeks, and then all of it was shining directly on the Obama campaign as soon as people sort of got a gander at what was going on.
Well, and part of the reason for that, I think, was I think McCain recognized that he was in trouble back at the time of the convention, that unless he did something to change the game and shake things up, he was going to lose. He was trying to somehow get a message of change out there that Obama had started with. He wasn't successful there. And if you look at the exit polls, they show that 60% of the voters had already made up their mind or said they had before September, and they were breaking heavily for Obama. It got even worse with the downturn of the economy, and I think it was over relatively
Mark,
early.
Mark, what was your polling showing on Palin, and would any other candidate have made a difference for McCain?
No.
Well, we're not in the business of kind of testing other candidates. I mean, we're in the business of basically looking at what's happening and trying to measure it and seeing what the effect is. Palin in California was clearly a negative. She didn't broaden the support levels to the groups that were in play. I mean, in my judgment, the groups that were in play were the declined state voters. She had ended up with more than a 2-to-1 negative image among those voters. She didn't help at all among Latino voters. If McCain was ever going to make a play for the Latino segment, she certainly wasn't the one. So, I mean, it played well to the base. It might have helped organizationally. It might have brought more excitement within the Republican Party, but the numbers among the groups that are pivotal to win California, you have to recognize that in this state, Republicans are now less than 1 out of 3 of all registered voters. They need help among other registered voters. They need to bring in the declined estate voters. This nomination didn't seem to recognize that, or at least didn't attempt to remedy that situation.
But I agree she wasn't picked to help California, but she is not the first vice presidential nominee in history to cost the election. No vice presidential nominee has ever done that. She's not it. The factors were much larger as to why the Republicans were not viewed favorably as the people to run this country in the next 4 years. And Sarah Palin was a very minor player in that. The Republicans have bigger other problems which cost them, which I write about. And there were other factors going Obama's way. I wrote a ton of factors. There's 10 factors that I wrote about why this was a Democrat year.
I don't think any of us said that she killed the ticket. I think we're just saying she didn't help.
Well, if it was a closer election, then you could look at something like that. You could take individual factors and say this was the thing that may have done it. But this election was far too foregone.
Right. This gives me a segue into sort of the Republican Party as a whole. Prop 8 gives me the segue because the morning after the election, I know that a lot of conservative leaders, including Grover Norquist, had a conference call with us reporters, and they talked about how the results of Prop 8 and two other measures in other states may confirm that traditional values, that's the way they put it, even though they didn't win the election, that traditional values were confirmed and reconfirmed. This is, you know, the future of the Republican Party. There is this split. Traditionalists, the traditional values crowd, or the moderates? Where does it need to go? And I'm just going to announce quickly, we're going to go to questions in 5 minutes. If you want to start lining up and asking some questions, the microphones are available over there.
This was not a traditional values national election. John McCain didn't bring up the issue hardly at all. So to say the national election went one way or the other based on traditional values, it was a non-factor. In the book I wrote, covers all the elections from Eisenhower forward, and that was a non-factor in this election. You know, the Prop 8 vote here, first of all, it's the latest vote, but it won't be anywhere near the last vote on this issue or even the parental notification. This is an issue that's here to stay. 52% voted for it this time. There was good campaigning on the yes side. I thought the no side didn't do as well. Jack O'Connell did himself ultimate damage, I think, going forward. But you know what? In a couple of years, it'll be back. It'll certainly be back in 4 years. And there's no last word on this subject. This is something people disagree with almost evenly, and it will carry on. And frankly, I don't think you can read too much into it either way, that this election was in California, that there was some great division or understanding based on a 52% vote.
Frank, what do you think it says about California?
Well, I think it says that California is close to accepting same-sex marriage. If you had asked me 6 months before the election how same-sex marriage would do on the ballot, I would say that it would be rejected. And it's amazing in many ways that Prop 8 passed by as narrow a margin as it has if you look at the historical trend of the polls. And I'm sure Mr. DiCamillo can talk about that this issue has been narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. There was undoubtedly something that happened on the Sunday before the election when people got up in the pulpit. I think if the anti-Prop 8 campaign had reached out to members of the black community and put good ads on earlier with representatives from those black communities, local leaders, Maxine Waters in Los Angeles and the like, I think the preachers in those communities would have been a lot less likely to have come out against the concept and for Prop 8. And I think there's a lot of things that could have been done earlier. But the polling shows, and Mr. DiCamillo can back me up on this, I'm sure, that there's a generational divide here, which is huge. And as older voters die off and are replaced by younger voters who are much more tolerant, it's only a question of another year, 2 years, maybe 5 years before I think we see it in the state.
That's true. But I would like to also say that the campaign itself, I think the post-election spin on Prop 8 made a lot about the black vote or even the Latino vote voting on the yes side. And there are different estimates as to the size of the yes vote for both groups. But my view is really it was race was really just a subsidiary issue. This was a vote about basic religion. And so, you know, the black African-American community may hold certain religious views in a certain way. That is not that surprising that they would, vote on this issue through that prism. It's different than other Democratic constituencies. But I think if an effective no campaign would have addressed the religious component, bringing ministers, bringing clergy to the table, to the no side, because that just looking at it through the political prism, I don't think really did the no side all that much
good.
And
just on top of that, I think there was an assumption on the No on 8 campaign's part that communities of color would equate this campaign to the civil rights movement, just flat out, take that for granted. And I think that was a very faulty assumption. I think I think there was a case to be made for that, but it was not adequately made by the campaign. And I think had they done a better job of doing that, it might have been a different outcome.
All right, we're going to take a break. And let's just throw it open to questions right now. Feel free to line up at the microphone and anyone who wants to ask. And as a reminder to our audience, this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're hosting President Obama. Let's break it down. I'm Carla Marinucci of the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm here with Frank Russo, founder of the California Progress Report, Mark DiCamillo, the director of the Field Poll, Josh Richmond, political blogger, and the Bay Area News Group, East Bay, and Tom Del Beccaro, vice chair of the California GOP and publisher of Political Vanguard. Now let's go to questions. Sir, go right ahead.
Hi, my question. Oh, no microphone. There we go. My question's for the whole panel. What if hypothetically, and I do say hypothetically for you, Tom, what if it were discovered when the Obama administration takes control and has access to classified information, if it were discovered that the Bush administration actually was guilty of high crimes involving extraordinary rendition, involving Guantanamo, et cetera, and that information became public, do you think that we would see a big review of that, a hold accountable type of thing, or do you think that President Obama would say, it's time to move on, I pardon President Bush for all of his crimes in office, let's just move forward?
Are you assuming there won't be a blanket pardon on January 19th?
I wonder that. If I were President Obama, the answer
of your question is if the Democrats turn the next 4 years into an investigation orgy while Rome continues to burn, then I think they will suffer. People want answers. That's why there are decisive votes sometimes. People want government to be responsive. And if the headlines of the next 4 years are investigations while the stock market continues to have trouble, while people are out of jobs, then they will be in trouble. If the Bush administration had spent its time, instead of cutting taxes in 2003, on investigating Bill Clinton, they would have he would have lost to John Kerry easily.
Well, I think Barack Obama and the administration that he's bringing in, which will include a large number of Republicans and people that have different points of view, much like Lincoln's cabinet, although I wouldn't overstate that analogy, is going to deal with the problems that the country is facing. He said the first thing that he wants to deal with is the economy and having a real plan there to create jobs and get us out of the mess that we're in. But having said that, I think he's capable of multitasking. I think he can chew gum and walk at the same time. And if there are these revelations, some things are going to be done about that. I'm happy to see that when he takes office, he's going to shut down Guantanamo Bay. Our standing in the world is going to go up, and I hope Americans see that and understand that.
I think Henry Waxman would be ready to hold more hearings. I don't think Joe Lieberman on government oversight in the Senate is likely to do so.
But I agree with Tom. I mean, if they overdo it, if this is the note that they play the most, I think that would not be a wise thing to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi. So as we all know, the economic problems kind of hit fairly late in the campaign. And so I've heard some suggestions that a lot of the things that the Obama campaign promised simply can't happen because there's no money left to do them. So I just kind of wanted to hear what everyone thought about whether Obama's going to be able to do the things that
healthcare,
he promised.
He has promised a lot of new spending. I think that's going to be really high. I think you're going to see a $1 trillion deficit. Because these deficits, my article today is these deficits are not your grandfather's deficits. And look, I think the Bush bailout, the way they've handled the $700 billion is abominable. And they've done a terrible job with that. And the Bush administration, down the stretch, the last 2 years, the Republicans have not done well enough. So, yeah, he's absolutely going to be constrained. And he's got to deal with a tough economic condition, and what's going to matter 4 years from now is the unemployment rate and what he did from day one. He can right now, the combined efforts of everybody that have gone before have got us where we are today. The Democrats will have the House, the Senate, big majorities or decent sized majority, not historically huge. And what's going to matter is what they do go forward. And if 4 years from now we're still in the same condition, they're going to be judged that way. If 4 years from now we're not in the same condition because they did something, they'll be judged that way. But he will be constrained because we're going to have $1 trillion deficit,
I also think that the economy is creating so much distress in the mass public that one of the things that Obama will be allowed to do, even as it expands the deficit, is to kind of reweave or create a better social net for a safety net. And I think that's going to entail, my own judgment, is that the issue of health care will be on the table very quickly in the first year, even though it requires a large amounts potentially of government monies. I think the public is going to be requiring it because of the insecurities that they're feeling in their loss of jobs, and it's becoming an issue that is beyond just those who don't have health insurance. It's becoming an issue of larger insecurity among people who have it, who worry that they or themselves or some member of their family is going to lose it. So I have a feeling, and I'm looking at Tom Daschle's appointment, he's the right individual to lead that charge, I think. I have a feeling that you're going to watch health care as a major issue in 2009.
And I'm sorry, but we've had the largest deficits, the largest run-up in the national debt that we've ever had in this country in the last 8 years. And if there's $700 billion to bail out corporations who still sometimes don't get it right and are still paying bonuses and saying it's with some other money that they have, not with the money they're getting from the government, and money is fungible, if there's money for that bailout, there's money to bail out the state of California, which needs help. There's money to bail out all sorts of things. And there may be large, very large deficits. The question is whether we get something for it and something that really helps people. And there are some things we cannot afford not to do. Healthcare is one of them. It's costing people a tremendous amount of money. There's a lot of dysfunction there. It's a lot more expensive to provide healthcare the way that we're providing it. That has to be done, and it may cost money. There was a study that just came out this week in California that there are more people dying due to air pollution in this state than there are dying in vehicle accidents. So, and the cost is billions. And it's billions not just in terms of, the cost of human lives and everything, but the loss of productivity, the cost to corporations in the state to have the air fouled up. So it's going to cost money to clean that up, but that's a wise investment. So if we make investments that actually help people and your average people and the middle class, I think there'll be support for that, and I think that's something that will do well, and the economy will grow rather than giving it to the top and tax breaks and all that like we've had for the last 8 years and this whole trickle-down idea.
Okay, let's take the next question. Thank you.
I'll probably belie my long association with a particular party that probably you'd find on the left. As an old Democrat, I have a feeling. I've been around politics for 50 years, and I always respected, even though I've been a Democrat through all that time, that there is a value in having a second viable party. But I feel that there's a total disconnect, and I'd really like to have a Republican Party that can disanchor itself from the 1930s. And, you know, a talk about the Republican Party not having the appropriate theme for this past election. And the supposition that somehow if Obama fails, maybe they can rejuvenate themselves, and maybe, you know, Palin can fly or can take her sled and come down.
Sir, what's the question, though?
Is there a viable Republican Party that could be relevant to our times and to our situation in this country, and one that could cooperate in some kind of a bipartisan and creative way with a Democratic regime?
Good question. Tom DelBacaro?
Look, the Republicans have been in the White House 28 out of the last 42 years. They're more than relevant. And the reality is that unquestionably in about late 2005, the Republicans stopped attempting to reform government and started participating in government for power's sake. And the Republican Congress, in my view, I wrote a book about it. The Republican Congress, called the New Conservative Paradigm, the Republican Congress made Republicans irrelevant because they did not do a good stewardess job, and they got fired. And what Republicans need to do going forward is very simple. We're in an age, folks, of huge budgets, huge deficits, huge government, and not huge answers. Government hasn't made your lives dramatically better. It hasn't made them better. What we need to do is make the government we have responsive and helpful to the people in ways that it can reasonably do, and we need to create the conditions by which people can succeed. And if 4 years from now the economy has turned around and government health care, if it's coming in large measure, is perceived as actually being responsive, then the Democrats will benefit from that. But if larger government comes along and there's not an actual perception that things have improved in ways that are measurable, then this Democrats will be turned out like the Republicans were turned out, because that's what voters do. They turn out parties that don't help people as opposed to parties that help themselves. And the Republicans in Congress were helping themselves in 2005 and 2006, and they got turned out. The Democrats need to not go in an orgy of investigations. They can't just grow government for government's sake. They have to be good stewards. Do they have a chance to do that? They do have a chance. I don't believe that government's the answer like they do, but we're going to see.
Okay, but who are the Republican leaders most likely to emerge? Well, I hate to look ahead to the next election already, but...
Look, Republicans nominate guys and gals that have run before. Every single nominee ultimately had run for president before. So if you're a Republican fan, that's pointing to Mitt Romney and Sarah Palin. I think you'll see Bobby Jindal. I think you'll see Mark Sanford of South Carolina. Charlie Crist of Florida. They're going to run for president, but I don't think the odds are against them from succeeding because they haven't run at the national level before. Republicans require that you have run before, seemingly. The Democrats aren't tethered to that theory. But unless that person makes the case that government can be streamlined and remain effective and help people, and they increase the private sector opportunities for people, then they're not going to succeed.
Okay, let's go to the next question because we've only got a couple more minutes.
Yeah, hi. This is for the panel. You all spoke about how the media coverage during the campaign was particularly favorable or light on Obama. And I'm curious now, as he starts to take office, do you think this will affect the persistent coverage now of his presidency? Or will the media, I suppose, be able to make the transition to being a bit more critical?
Yes,
that's,
honeymoon.
That's not what
is
I
there
said.
A honeymoon? What do you think, Josh?
It depends. 77% of, or 85% of the stories about Bill Clinton's economy were good, and the same, virtually same exact numbers in the Bush administration, 77%, were negative. 85% of the stories about Reagan's economy were negative, even though it had 92 months of growth. It will turn on Obama, just like it turned on Clinton, if sideshows become the issue. But if he can stay focused and move forward on an agenda and not have issues like Monica Lewinsky, then I think the media will probably be kinder to him than Clinton if he can stay out of that kind of trouble.
Well, boy, I sure don't think that the coverage of Obama was light. I mean, with all the Reverend Wright that I saw and all sorts of things over and over and over again.
You're a big Hillary fan now.
There seems to be disagreement.
Right is right. So well, I think ultimately there's so much focus, and I think it's going to be unfair. Obama should not be scrutinized 24/7 by the fact that he smokes and the media doesn't show that he smokes. I think we shouldn't talk about that. We should not talk about the progress of his children. FDR would have crumbled under what Obama's going to face, and that's too bad because it's bad for the country if we so turn these people's guts inside out to find out about them in some regards while they're president trying to do things. Familiarity breeds contempt. They turned on Bill Clinton because he gave him the rope to do it. If Obama doesn't give him the rope, then frankly, he's going to continue to get favorable coverage.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the next question.
This is more of a budget question than an Obama or a McCain question, but in rough figures, I was looking at the year-end, the national debt as of September 30, 2007, and at that point it was roughly $9 trillion. In September 30, 2008, it was roughly $10 trillion, and the deficit for the year was about $500 billion, which causes me to wonder, what's the additional, why did the debt go up by a trillion, but the deficit was only $500 billion? Where's the remaining $500 billion, and how come we don't hear about it, or are my figures wrong?
Well, I can tell you this. In 2017, Medicare and Social Security are going to be underwater. Right now, they produce surpluses of $300 billion. They're going to produce underwater $250 to $300 billion in a decade from now, meaning that's a swing a half a trillion to the negative simply because of demographics. The way deficits are caused, and this is the subject of my article today, these are not your grandfather's deficits. Deficits are caused. We have a system of government now, ever since the Great Society, where if the economy goes down, revenues go down, and government expenditures automatically go up. If your income goes down, you tend to stop spending. We have, this is true of all social welfare states, even true of Rome. And right now, we have to find a way to get the economy moving again to kick off more tax revenues. So ultimately, the answer to your question is we have got to find a way to turn the economy around. That's what's going to close the deficit for Obama. When the Bush tax cuts were fully in place between 2003 and 2005, revenues went up $700 billion a year, $700 billion after the tax cuts. So the tax cuts resulted in more government income. Right now, it's heading back down, and that's why the deficit's enlarging. The best thing that Obama can do and the Democrats is to get the economy to turn around to kick off more tax revenues and be moderate on their income or their expenditures. I don't think it's good. I think you're going to see a $1 trillion deficit. And I think the economy, frankly, is going to be bad for the next 6 years because no one's addressing the basic fact. We have the second highest tax burden in American history. Under those circumstances, the U.S. economy has never performed well. We have the highest tax burden means you're going to have a recession. And until the middle class and all Americans have an opportunity to have their taxes reduced, you're going to have a soft economy.
quickly, gentlemen, we got about 15 seconds each for this, but I just want to take last question from me. You know, how long is the honeymoon, particularly, well, not just with the conservatives, but with the progressives also pressuring him on the other side? How long does Obama have in the golden glow?
Not long. I already hear some progressives. We are right here in the heart of progressive land, and I already hear a lot of people concerned about some of the cabinet and staff appointments that the president-elect is making, and some concerns over the direction his policy is taking. I think the honeymoon may be coming to an end.
Frank,
already.
I take a different view. I think he's got an opportunity if he can deliver on a few fundamental policy issues. He needs to call his shots, but if he can deliver major packages such as on health reform in the first year, I think he'll extend the honeymoon even into the second year.
And I think if he produces, if he talks to people, if there's a real dialogue as opposed to what we've had in the Bush administration where they went with their agenda and the facts be damned and the people be damned and opinion be damned and they did things secretly and got us into a war the way they did and everything else that's happened, I think if he talks to people, I think if there's real debate within the cabinet, he's a good listener, and I think that's going to transcend ideology.
I think the reality is that he's in a tough situation. I think if 13 months from now the economy has turned around and is moving north, it continues. But 4 years from now, I think he's going to have a very hard time getting reelection because I don't think people are going to address the underlying problem in the economy, which is that our tax burden is too high, and the U.S. economy has never turned around under these circumstances without tax relief. I don't think that's going to happen. And that's partly the Republicans' fault as well.
Can we come back and debate taxes?
or the media?
We have run out of time for tonight. Let's give a big hand to our panelists for their thoughts here tonight. This meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.